being lonely is very bad. I mean, it will kill you. Like, you're more likely to have all kinds of diseases. You die sooner.
That's Kristen Radke, this week's guest for episode 266, if I'm counting right, of the Creative Nonfiction Podcast. Now in its ninth year, it's the show where I speak to badass people about the art and craft of telling true stories. Kristen is the art director for The Believer magazine, and her new book, Seek You, A Journey Through American Loneliness, combines her beautiful drawings with meditations on what loneliness is, the epidemic of loneliness, we might call it. It spoke to me, and I shared several instances of my chronic battles with loneliness with her, but I deleted most of them. So, support for the Creative Nonfiction Podcast brought to you by West Virginia Wesleyan College's Low Residency MFA in Creative Writing. Now in its 10th year, this affordable program boasts a low student-to-faculty ratio and a strong sense of community. Recent CNF faculty include Randon Billings Noble, Jeremy Jones, and CNF Pod alum Sarah Einstein. There's also fiction and poetry tracks, with recent faculty including Ashley Bryant Phillips and Jacinda Townsend, as well as Diane Gilliam and Savannah Sipple. No matter your discipline, if you're looking to up your craft or learn a new one, consider West Virginia Wesleyan, right in the heart of Appalachia. Visit mfa.wvwc.edu for more information and dates of enrollment. And support for the podcast is also brought to you by HippoCamp 2021. It's about a month from now. It's back in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Registration's open. It's a conference for creative nonfiction writers. Marion Winnick will be this year's keynote speaker. We've got a debut CNF author panel featuring Lily Danziger, Greg Mania, Carol Smith, and Janine Ouellette. It's August 13th through the 15th. Dig it, man. Use the promo code CNFPOD21 to get $50 off your registration fee. So Kristen Radke, R-A-D-T-K-E, don't forget that T, is the author of the graphic nonfiction book Imagine Wanting Only This from 2017, and of course her new one, Seek You, and she received the 2019 Whiting Creative Nonfiction Grant for it, a very prestigious grant. And she got a forthcoming book, I don't know when the pub date is, but it's called Terrible Men. Should strike a chord. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Harper's, Marie Claire, The Atlantic, The Guardian, Elle, Vogue, NPR.org, and many other places. You can find her at Kristen Radke on Twitter and on Instagram at Kristen Radke _. So we talk about loneliness, the writing and drawing tools at her disposal, and social media, among lots of other things. You might hear a vacuum come into play partway through this. I used my tools to the best of my ability to tamp it out. I had to cut quite a bit from this interview because it was too loud to bear in some areas. But you're still left with a nice little conversation, me hopes. Show notes and other ways to support the podcast are at brendanomero.com. Hey. So you ready to get after it? You digging the lean opening? Better or worse? Any case, here we go.
What am I reading these days? We go through these cycles at my day job at the Believer magazine where there are twice in every magazine cycle when I'm just like glued to my computer and only looking at the Believer magazine. And one is when the issue goes live online, and the other is when the issue goes to press. And we're doing both of those simultaneously right now. So right now, the only thing I'm reading is the Believer magazine.
Yeah. And I love that. I love talking day job stuff with people who come on the show. I think it puts a lot of other people's minds at ease too, because when we see celebrity type writers or people we really admire, sometimes we think that when they have that book come out or they have a book that's getting some attention, that like that is the only thing.
That's it. Yeah, they can quit their job and it'll make them rich or something.
Exactly right. And you've got, you know, prominent bylines. You're art director for Believer, you know, prime as a, you know, as your day job. And then you've got these beautiful books that you turn out. It's so it's good to see good to see that. And I love getting people to talk about that. So, you know, in what ways are you be able to sort of thread the creative work that you want to do, like Seek You, around your day job?
It's hard. I mean, I think that one of the great benefits of my day job is, well, one, it's a creative job. I work with artists who kind of understand that we all have these creative projects going on in addition to our day jobs. But also I live on the East Coast and my job is on the West Coast. So my time can be a little bit flexible. You know, I have a couple of hours in the morning to work before everybody else that I work with wakes up. And so it means I don't have a ton of time in the evenings because I'm often working late. But I've never been one of those people who can like put in a full day at work and then come home and write at, you know, like 8 p.m. That just, you know, by that point, like I need to only like watch Netflix and like eat junk food. So right. I feel like actually that's been like the, like kind of the saving grace of my job is that I have that morning time.
Yeah. And given that you have a creative day job and you're creative outside of work, what's your relationship to, you know, burning out or making sure you don't burn out, given that both things are, you know, creatively a creative foundation, if you will?
I have no advice about avoiding burnout because I don't know how to do it. I mean, I think that, yeah, I don't know. I think I go through phases where I'm like deeply overwhelmed. And then, you know, a couple of days or weeks later after the things that I was really trying to focus on are a little bit behind me, it's like, oh, okay. And so I try to remember when I'm inside of those cycles, like, you know, where the issue is going to press and I'm on deadline for some freelance projects and whatever, that they do pass. But in general, I think as I've gotten older, I've also felt more comfortable with stepping away from work in a way that when I was starting out, like before my first book came out, I felt like I had a lot to prove, which is not to say I feel like confident in where I am in my career and that I don't have anything to prove, but I feel like I can take a breath. It's like, okay, I made a book. I can breathe for a second and like look at this guy or at plants or, you know, eat junk food and watch Netflix, and that's okay.
What's your junk food of choice?
I mean, I cannot discriminate. Probably like gummy bears, but really I have a very broad palate for junk food.
What is the nature of being in the art director for Believer magazine?
So my favorite part of the job is that I edit our comics section. And so I get to work on narrative nonfiction comics and work with new artists, emerging artists, established artists. And that's a very collaborative process. Particularly now, we're doing a lot of interactive comics or animated comics online, and that the process of translating something from print to digital in that way is like very exciting and fun for me. And then I also, you know, commission editorial art, cover art, feature art, stuff like that.
Who are some of the illustrators out there who inspire you and put fuel in your tank?
I'll say that the people I can keep talking about, the Believer, Lisa Hook is an illustrator I worked with, a cartoonist I worked with on an animated comic called The Vine and the Fish about the xenophobic naming of invasive species. It is nominated for a National Magazine Award in digital storytelling, which is really exciting.
Wow.
And I love the work that she does. Her book is called Names and Faces, is coming out from Holt in a couple of years, and she will definitely be a cartoonist to pay attention to and watch.
I love Brian Ray too, who does a lot of the work for like a modern love, and he also has you know, a lot of books too. His sensibility is just, it's so sort of crude and pared down, but just hilarious too.
Which is like one of the things that comics can do so well, is that sort of pared down quality. You know, you can reduce something to its most essential parts.
Yeah, I remember hearing him on an interview, like, because when his book Death Wins a Goldfish came out, you know, there's a drawing in there where he does do something that's very photorealistic with I believe it's like a Monet painting, and so he said something like, I like that I was able to pull that off, because like a lot of my other drawing just looks like a, you know, basically a 10-year-old did it, but he's just like, I have the skill to do this. And Linda Barry's the same way.
Yeah,
you know, they have the skill to do something that's really fine and technical, but they kind of just elect to take their foot off the gas and do something that's a little more crude.
Yeah, it is really interesting to see artists work in different styles. Like someone like Art Spiegelman too, if you look through his stuff, sometimes he'll, you know, enter this different mode and it's like, whoa, you know, I didn't know that was also a part of your arsenal.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I love that. Like, kind of part of your arsenal. There are different modes of creativity and writing and and everything. And it's just like, this is what I want to do. This is the best mode to tell the story. And I'm going to sort of, you know, it's like a pitcher having four or five different pitches. It's like, depending on the situation and the count that the batter is under, it's like, all right, I'm going to change speeds, or I'm going to just throw a fastball by him. So it's just I like that term of having like an artistic, different arrows in your quiver.
Yeah. I mean, I don't understand sports metaphors at all, but I trust you that that's what it's like. But it's true. I mean, it is true that, you know, writing and drawing are both about voice. And just like you might switch into a different tone or a different voice in prose, you can also do that in illustration.
Voice. That's something I love unpacking on this show, and the development and the cultivation of voice. So how did you arrive at your particular style, writing voice, and even your visual voice, if you will?
I don't know. I mean, I think that my writing voice is just kind of what naturally came out, which isn't to say that I haven't, you know, worked hard and that it hasn't been refined over time, but I don't feel like I've intentionally tried to push it towards a specific mode. You know, so, I mean, certainly like you enter a more ruminative mode or a, you know, more serious tone. I'm not sure if that's really the same as voice. I always kind of get confused about ultimately what voice is in the end, but I feel like in drawing, my first book was kind of just how I drew naturally. It's like, that's just what came out. And for this book and for other projects and for future projects, I do try to think a little bit more about, you know, how can I best tell this story through a visual tone or a visual voice? Does that mean paring back? Does that mean, you know, incorporating limited palettes or, you know, more extreme palettes, more varied palettes, things like that?
Well, something that struck me about Seek You was the use of just color as a storytelling element. And is that something that's always on your forefront about how, you know, how color is going to elucidate a certain kind of, you know, a timbre or mood?
I would say it's not at the forefront. Color is secondary. I often will draw a lot of a project before I go back and color it, just because I might change the direction or something might get cut. And I'm trying to just produce the work before I kind of go back and add a palette to it. Just as a matter of like basic, you know, self-protection in terms of my time. But I will say the color is very difficult for me. I read a lot about color theory and looked at a ton of models for this project because color is also its own language. You know, it can communicate a lot of emotion. And when you put two different colors next to each other, it's like each color changes dramatically. So it is like a complicated formula. And it did take me a really, really long time to get it to where it is now.
Yeah, when I've had conversations with political cartoonists too, where the writing has to be super lean and you know, the drawing has to do its own heavy lifting, sometimes they go hand in hand. Sometimes the writing comes first and then it's like, how am I going to illustrate it? Sometimes the illustration speaks for itself and you're like, all right, I'm going to write to the picture. For you, what's the calculus? What kind of, if you can put a finger on it or something, what tends to come first, the writing or the drawing?
Usually the writing, almost always the writing. I mean, I might have a sort of abstract idea in my mind of something I would like to draw, you know, like, oh, I'd really love to draw like a panoramic, you know, spread about of whatever, this street or, you know, whatever. You know, I might have an idea in my head for an image, but it's usually always the text comes first. Although I do work back and forth. Like I generally wouldn't storyboard or script an entire project, like a book length project, before I would start to draw, because the drawing, you know, I might do that in sections and chunks and then draw as I go. But one, that's just so arduous. Like the drawing is almost like a mental break from the writing in a certain way. So I feel like I can be more productive when I move back and forth. And two, I think they're more interesting when they're in conversation like that, where like the art isn't a response to the writing, but the art is really talking to and informing the writing early. And as I draw, it also changes my relationship to the text. And I realize maybe the text needs to be saying something different, or the text needs to be saying less or more or something like that.
And so you grew up in Wisconsin, is that right?
I did.
You know, what kind of a kid were you? Were you that kind of a solitary kid drawing and writing and all that? Or were you kind of a social butterfly?
I was definitely the solitary kid drawing and writing, which isn't to say I didn't want to be more of a social butterfly, but I lived in a very rural place, and I had quite strict parents. So I was, you know, I was very much like, you know, I had very limited time with my friends or with people my own age. And so I spent a lot of time, I think, like brooding in my room with drawing or writing. So it actually turned out to be a gift, although my social skills were probably delayed as a result.
In what way were your parents strict?
I mean, they were just, you know, I was their first kid. I was the only girl in my family. They're very Catholic, like, you know, nothing yeah. ultimately that original, you know. It's pretty you know,
a very trite form of strictness. I like that. Like, guys, you, I don't care that you're strict, but you're so cliche about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a moment early in your book too where you say, like, during my own childhood, my dad had the demeanor of the fathers I'd read about in the historical novels I hoarded in my room. Stoic, mm-hmm. religious, extraordinarily strict.
Yeah, that's him. He did not, he's read a copy of it, and he did not take, sometimes he argues with me about things that I write, and he'll be like, that's not how it was, but he had no comment for that one. So I felt like I got it right.
When a book that I've still trying to get published, it's a memoir largely about my father and baseball. And when I had given him a copy of the draft, because he was very uncooperative when I was doing sort of my reporting for it, and sure. I'm like, well, this is kind of how I remember things, and I let him read it, and he was just writing like bullshit throughout the whole thing. And I'm just like, well, you could have offered input when I asked for it. And they tend to remember things a lot differently.
Is that important to you? Like someone else's recollection of events?
It is, because I'm sort of a journalist at heart. Mm-hmm. So it's important to me to get like all sides of the story. And sure. even if their recollection of it is in conflict with mine, I kind of mm-hmm. like the idea of playing those off each other.
You're interested in sort of that space yeah. between two people's recollections.
Yeah, exactly. But then again, there are other times where I'll think, oh, well, you know, whatever. This is how I remember it through the research I've done into my own life. This is how this was my truth, if you will. Mm-hmm. If you have a problem with it, go write your own.
Yeah, so, there you go.
So there's that element of it. You know, what kind of things, you know, maybe have your father or your mother taken issue with, or, you know.
It's never that any, you know, no one in my family has ever taken issue with anything I've written, which I feel very lucky about. It's more that they are like, that's not how it was. Or, and sometimes I'll realize they're right. You know, I'm not one of those people that's like wildly interested in the notion of verifiable truth. Like,
yeah,
you know, I mean, it's not necessarily why I'm not writing necessarily as a journalist. You know, if I were, you know, if I'm writing about someone else's life in a journalistic way, of course, I really do want to get that right. You know, like, it's mostly like, I remember after my last book, there was this scene that happened in Colorado, and my dad was like, funny that you wrote it like that's how it happened. And only when he said that, I realized that I actually completely constructed what had happened, like, for, you know, narrative effect or whatever. And I was like, oh yeah, that was completely incorrect. And it, you know, it's never been anything that's like dramatically changed the meaning of anything, but I think it is interesting, you know, writing just like the way it's like, I mean, writing is storytelling, and I'm sure we've all experienced telling a story so many times that we barely remember what it was like in the first place anymore.
So at what point do you start thinking, okay, yeah, I kind of want to be an illustrator and a writer. I mean, when does that take root?
I, you know, I was always writing. I was always drawing. I didn't know you could do them at the same time. You know, I didn't really grow up in comics. If there was a comic shop in my hometown, I was not cool enough to know about it. But I, you know, towards the end of grad school, I started experimenting, like, with video essays and with, you know, kinds of illustrated essays. And my last semester of grad school, I thought, why don't I just try a comic and see how that goes? And I thought, well, that turned out, you know, better than I thought it would, but there's no way I'm ever doing that again, because it was a horrible process, you know, like it's grueling, and it's, you know, the first time you do something, you're also just like groping around in the dark. I mean, in a certain way, you always are groping around in the dark as an artist. You never like learn how to do something concretely, because it's different every time you approach it. But it took me then a couple of years after that to kind of come around to the fact that my first book would be entirely illustrated.
How did you start to find your path through, you know, illustration and writing. It's very, it seems very targeted, and I don't see the path myself as just primarily as a writer. But how did you, start going down the more well-trodden path, or take a machete out and hack your own way through the jungle? How'd you go about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually I was actually quite lucky. I mean, anyone who has any level of success is lucky, but I would say that even anyone who publishes anything ever, you know, for the first time is lucky, because it is such a, you know, it's just such a gamble. I don't know. I think I was lucky in particular because I came from the literary world. I had relationships in the literary world, and then I started drawing. And so like my literary contacts were like, oh, this is something different than the stuff I normally see. And so sometimes it felt like there was an opportunity to place things in venues maybe I wouldn't have been able to at that stage in my career publish prose, because it was just different. And so I think that was like something that was, I was really lucky to do. I started doing these graphic book reviews, illustrated book reviews. And I think those were some of the first publications I ever got, was I did book reviews basically in comics form.
Oh, that's cool. I've recently, and I think it was just because I was reading, you know, in reading your latest book too, how it would be, I don't know, kind of like a fun project to do, like to basically have like a monthly, you know, an online magazine where you're covering like the local community. Mm-hmm. And it's basically a graphic novel of that month. And it's like a city council meeting or like a big one or something. And it's just like an illustrated city council meeting, and there's actual quotes from the people, and, you know, the prose is sort of the illustration itself. And there's the dialogue and the back and forth. And it was like, oh, this is kind of a different way to sort of actually digest the news. And it's colored in a certain way. I don't know. It's sort of an exciting medium for me as someone who's, I just enjoy it a lot. It really, yeah. It sinks into my brain better.
Yeah, that's nice to hear. I mean, I think that comics journalism is a very interesting space. You know, it's a very limited space because there aren't that many people that do it, and because it takes so much time. You know, it's not like you can, I mean, some cartoonists certainly draw much faster than I do, but, you know, it would be difficult, I think, to do like a seriously reported piece, you know, on like a breaking news thing, and also draw it in, you know, in 2 days or something like that. But I think there are, you know, it's like another way to tell stories, and it can be a more empathetic form or genre. It's not that it's more empathetic, but I think it has a lot of opportunity for empathy and for, you know, humanizing large issues that are sometimes hard to grasp.
Where would you say you're most alive and most engaged in the process of, generating, you know, drawings or even the writing?
When it's finished and I get to close my computer. There are like, you know, every part that works feels like a miracle because it happens so rarely. Like at the beginning, maybe you have an idea and that feels really exciting. It also can feel horrible and terrifying because you're looking at this sort of expanse of nothing that you have to fill. But, you know, there are these moments where you have like these sort of like aha moments, and it feels like an epiphany. And things start to click into place. And, you know, for me, for a book length project, feeling has to happen like hundreds of times before I actually get where I need it to go. But those moments are really exciting, of like, I had this problem, I didn't know how to solve it, I'm kind of figuring it out. And then looking back at something, like if I don't know if you've ever experienced, or I think a lot of writers can relate to seeing like a very early draft of something they finished and are proud of, and seeing the space between those two things. And how like terrible that first version was be really exciting, because it gives you also hope for the terrible thing you're working on now, that it can become something a little bit better.
How have you gotten comfortable doing enough bad work to get to good work?
Great question. I think that I have reminded myself that the bad parts, with some exceptions, can be mostly just for me. It's kind of like being embarrassed or feeling shame or something like that. Like that is a feeling you don't have to share with anybody. It can just be like this like private thing that you deal with. And because part of feeling for me, I mean, like writing is just deeply embarrassing. Making work is deeply embarrassing because it's, you know, it's like narcissistic and totally pointless. In the apocalypse, these books will seem absurd and we will use them all for, you know, fuel and heat. But there is this, I try to remind myself, I guess, when I'm in like the muck of it, that this is just the thing you have to wade through, and it doesn't have to be sort of a part of your, you know, your identity or your overall consciousness. But I think a lot of writers, I have friends who are wildly talented who stop themselves when they're in that spot because they're so perfectionistic. And you just have to keep working through it. I mean, the most important thing you can possibly do is just produce work. And then, because the more you have, the easier it is to winnow down. And the more you have, the easier it becomes to work, and the smarter you become.
Absolutely. I love hearing you say, you know, the muck of it. And, you know, I call it sometimes the ugly middle, just the muddy middles of these things. You know, you're far enough away from the honeymoon phase of a project where you're like, this is great. And then you're like, this fucking sucks.
Yeah, totally.
And like for you, is it just a matter of putting your head down to get to to see the lighthouse in the distance and keep going? That like the only way through it is through it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, my husband or my friends will sometimes say, like, just to put it away for a while, like if you're stuck. And I've always kind of resisted that. I don't think that by walking away from something, you're getting it done. Like that just, to me, that's just antithetical. But yeah. I do think, you know, that, which isn't to say that sometimes you're not forced to take steps away from a project, like when you're waiting for your editor to give you notes and you have to take, or you're, you know, something like that, and you take a month off or something like that. I've definitely done that for the project I'm working on now. But I think in general, the longer you just kind of have to sit and sit and sit until like you realize that you have this thing inside of you. Like there is just like a, it is, it's like the cliche of there's no way, there's nowhere, whatever. What is it saying? There's nowhere to go. There's no way out but through or something like that.
Yeah. Something like that. I'm blanking on it too, but that sounds good.
Let's go with that.
Yeah. As a, you know, what does your workspace look like? What are the tools at your disposal when you're, you know, when you're writing and when you're drawing?
I have my computer, my tablet, a Wacom Cintiq tablet, and I draw on that. And I'll often have photo references like on my iPad sitting in between my computer and my tablet. And then I'll have a lot of books and the internet. The internet.
Nice. Do you have any rituals that start your creative day in a way that you know, primes the pump for you to get your work done?
Not really, but I have found that like when I've been at residencies, the act of walking from the place where I sleep into a different building, into a studio or an office, is like absolutely transformative. Like that completely changes the way I feel. It's like something clicks inside my body and I can start to work in a way that, I mean, I'm lucky enough to have a home office, which in New York is like an unbelievable luxury, but it's still my house. And it's also the place that I do my day job, because I work remotely, certainly this year, but a lot of the time on non-pandemic years. So that space gets muddied. It's like, you know, they say you're not supposed to like read or like work in bed because your brain doesn't know when to go to sleep. It feels a little bit like that. One of the other things that I found when I've been at residencies and I had room to move around is that like basic stuff like stretching is like makes a huge difference, I think, in how you feel.
Nice. And where was my notes here? Oh, I love the piece that you just recently had in the New York Times. You know, you were, you know, writing about, you know, loneliness and tethering that to your book. And I love that you said something that, you know, you put every ounce of your heart into this. So in what way was this topic like so really close to the bone for you?
I think that it's just like being lonely is just being a human person. And so I felt like I was writing about, like, you know, I mean, it's like sounds cheesy, but like the human condition in a way that I haven't before, because to me, I think it's like, you know, it's this extremely universal feeling. It's this thing in a way that kind of connects us. Like our isolation is also like, you know, what we all have in common. And so I also think that loneliness is such a broad and complicated thing that it just took me down these avenues I didn't expect. And so it was both like less personal and more personal than I would have thought when I first started the project. So I don't know. Like, I think it really surprise me how intensely I felt about the subject as I was writing it.
Yeah, there was a, Speaking of loneliness, it's something I contend with and have contended with forever and ever. And one particular moment struck me, and I always go back to it. It's when I was a sports writer for this newspaper in upstate New York, and I would get back late at night, you know, 1 a.m, and I was just like me and my dog, and I would watch, you know, Simpsons DVDs, but I would watch them with the commentary on. So it felt like I had like a group of like five friends watching an episode of The Simpsons. And it was like this thing to appease my loneliness at the time. So,
yeah, I totally relate to that.
But I guess my point being, like, I like that you solicited, you know, some commentary from a lot of other people about like their most lonely moment in their lives. Like, how important was that for you to include that into, you know, your sort of your exploration of loneliness?
I don't know that it was important as much as it was just like moving to me to hear kind of like a collective voice. I think I've become more and more interested in that over time, like particularly when we're talking about like giant issues like loneliness. I mean, it surprised me when I first started talking about loneliness, like just with my friends when I was working on it, how much people wanted to talk about it, because we don't really talk about loneliness. And people had such, you know, I think just like feelings of like pain or sadness or joy, like it's such an extreme emotion or state that people were just able to recall such specific moments and memories in a way that did really surprise me. And I found them just to be very beautiful.
What do you think it is about loneliness that is so... It has a very deep taproot in us. Yeah. And like, you know, a lot of people can remember those very, like the moment I was most lonely, and it can come to the forefront very fast. Like, what do you think that is about it?
It's biological. It's like being hungry. You know, it's something that we need, we need human connection in order to survive, like in terms of, you know, all through our evolution and pretty much today. I mean, like being lonely is really dangerous. I mean, that's one of the things I didn't expect to learn, or I didn't anticipate discovering, I guess, or that it was even true when I started working on the book, is that being lonely is very bad. I mean, it will kill you. Like you're more likely to have all kinds of diseases. You die sooner. So it's, you know, we remember it and it feels so extreme to us because it is an extreme state and it's something we have to fix.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about the, you talked about loneliness being, that it can kill you. Talk a little bit about the horrible rhesus monkey experiments from I'm blanking on the scientist, but you'll know.
Harry Harlow. Yeah.
Yeah. Like those really just cruel experiments. So, you know, talk a little bit about that.
So Harry Harlow, very famous, scientist. Ooh, my neighbor has started vacuuming. I hope that that will not be too loud.
You'll be fine.
Apologies if you hear it. Harry Harlow very famously studied rhesus monkeys. It's called the mother surrogate mother study, where he separated baby monkeys from their mothers at birth and put them with two fake mothers. One was made of wire and one was made of cloth, and the wire mother dispensed milk, and that was meant to dispel he was hoping to dispel the rumor, or like the belief at the time, that babies only really loved their mothers because they like kept them alive and fed them. And that turned out to be the opposite experience that the monkeys had. They really wanted the soft, more loving seeming mother than the other, what, like inanimate wire monkey. But what kind of happened to Harry over time was that he lost his mind. Like his studies became more and more kind of depraved, and he really began, I mean, certainly like isolating a monkey and separating it from its mother is already torture, but he started torturing them in pretty extreme ways and created, you know, extreme situations for isolation. And I was just, you know, I became really fascinated by him. I think like in any kind of science or, you know, these important historical figures, we sort of think through them about the contributions that they make to science, but we don't think through the impulses there that led them to those discoveries or to that mode of inquiry. And Harry was a very depressed, very lonely person. And it was like he was enacting his sort of pain, confusion, suffering into these monkeys.
Yeah, especially this horrifying was the solitary pit, like the triangle.
Oh yeah, the pit of despair.
the pit of despair where, yeah, it's just like, you know, event they would fight to try to claw to get out. And eventually they just curled up in a bomb, gave up.
Yeah. And those monkeys like never recovered. If a monkey had been in isolation for more than a year like that, there was no way for them to regain or rejoin the colony. Something in their brains were just obliterated and it was impossible. Equally interesting is that a lot of times when an isolated monkey was put in a cage or a habitat with monkeys that had been normally socialized, the monkeys that had been normally socialized just tried to kill the outsider.
Mm. Yeah. And then there was the part of the study as well, where they took like an isolated monkey and it had grown up, and then they're like, oh, let's breed them and see if they become, you know, well-adjusted mothers. And they rejected and somehow outright, you know, and committed infanticide because they couldn't, they just weren't adjusted properly.
Yeah. They didn't have any idea of how to care for another living thing if they'd never, you know, experienced being around other living things. And, you know, so much of our certainly we have biological impulses, but we also learn how to hone them by modeling behavior and by observing other people. And the same thing is true for monkeys and for a lot of animals, but particularly monkeys, because they're really just so similar to humans. I mean, they're so close to us.
Mm. You also write and talk about how in popular culture, especially, that sometimes this loneliness or the solitary genius is very much celebrated, like, you know, a Don Draper or Walter White, if you will, like these kind of lone geniuses and, you know, wallowing in that kind of isolation. You know, in what ways is that myth incredibly toxic to the culture?
I would say in every way that myth is incredibly toxic. I mean, first of all, it's a very masculine trope. Like, it's rare that there are women that operate in that mode. Like, you of course have like the, you know, like Mare of Easttown right now. I'm watching that along with everybody else. Like, you know, Kate Winslet is kind of that male anti, you know, that male sort of isolated figure there. Like, she's definitely stepping into that. She's sort of eschewing gender roles with that in that mode, but not really, like, not quite in the same way. But I mean, the argument I make in the book is that those kind of lonely heroes on TV now, the Don Drapers or whoever else, are just like, they're sort of just like renditions of the American cowboy. But, and I think that's also rooted in, you know, Americans love the underdog, Americans love outsiders, Americans love, you know, American individualism and American exceptionalism. So I think those things are undeniably tied, but also, like, there is sort of like this, you know, lonely men characterized in that way, like, you know, handsome outsiders or something like that. It's very different than, like, they're not seen as pathetic because they're still desired. Like, Don Draper never has trouble finding someone to sleep with him. He's just like annoyed by everyone and like superior to them.
Yeah. In what way has social media exacerbated the whole problem with loneliness, the epidemic of loneliness, if you will?
I don't know if it has. I think that, I mean, certainly, like, if you look at the science of it, or like what psychologists say, they say like people who post more selfies on social media are more likely to be depressed or whatever, or like you stuff like that. But I think that social media, I don't know. I don't think I have quite worked out like causality there. If they're, you know, I don't know if we're sort of enacting, I don't know if social media is a new platform to experience the same problem we've always had, or if it has exacerbated it. I mean, I think it's probably likely that it's exacerbated it, but I do feel like, I don't know. Like, I think we've always been very lonely as a people. Certainly maybe less so when we were all living in, you know, villages and really depended on one another to survive. But in general, I think that social media is just sort of like a magnifying glass, maybe more than it is an amplifier in this particular case. Like, certainly I don't feel that way about, like, you know, politics or something like that, because there's no denying that social media has completely obliterated our, you know, ideas of truth, et cetera, et cetera.
I really struggle with social media because I feel like it has a more insidious effect on people's psyche. I think it just makes, at least with me, I'll just speak for myself, it just tends to make me feel lousy most of the time, because it's that old adage, is nothing unique or nothing, no new insight here. But yeah, it's always comparing everyone else's highlight reel to how crappy you feel on an everyday basis.
Well, it's like, you know, it's like the, you know, as anyone who's ever, you know, I have a friend who's in recovery, and one of the mantras of AA is don't judge your insides by somebody else's outsides. And like, certainly social media is a way to just see what someone has very carefully put into the world and compare that, like when you're in your house looking like shit, feeling depressed, like, you know, it's those juxtapositions. But I think, I don't know, I totally understand what you mean about that part of social media. And I think I've related to that a lot. But I also feel like there are ways in which we can use it powerfully and valuably as a connecting tool, you know, say people who are sort of geographically isolated from one another or something like that. Like, I definitely feel like I've been able to, for example, if I have a friend who has a child on the other side of the country and we only see each other once or twice a year, I do feel more connected to them throughout the year than I would have previously if because they're posting videos and stuff like that or photos and stuff like that. Like, I feel like it actually, in a certain way, it helps me develop feelings of love for people who I don't see every day, because I feel like they're still kind of present with me in a way that certainly communicating via text and stuff like that. But I don't know. I think that there are opportunities for us to use it to our benefit. Although I do agree there are a lot of risks associated with it. And I tend to not enjoy, I don't follow people who I think are constantly, you know, posting like artful selfies, and the sort of Instagram influencer, you know, sphere is a horrible, horrible space that I just don't interact with at all. I only follow people that I really like in real life. And so rarely do I really feel that kind of annoyance. But I think I've also tried, I've been very careful to not, you know, allow, if there's someone that I know, even maybe someone that I like, who I'm like, man, they posted 700 pictures of their, you know, upstate house restoration or their, you know, whatever. And it's just like driving me nuts. Like, I'll just mute them, you know, like there is that. God, I hope that's not a real example that, and someone doesn't listen to this and is like, oh, no wonder you're not commenting on my posts anymore. But there is, you know, there, it's like, I've been trying to be more careful about it. It's like, if this is giving you negative feelings, just like stop engaging with it, which is of course easier on social media than it is in like your job or your family or something.
Yeah. I love the Maggie Nelson quote you cite in a piece you wrote, that loneliness is solitude with a problem. Mm. Like, what about that really struck a chord with you?
I mean, it's so simple. Like, it's such a clear, incredible description. I mean, it's probably the best or one of the best descriptions of loneliness I've ever read, because it is just sort of perfectly, that's just perfectly what it is. I mean, there are of course other variations of loneliness. Like, you can be very lonely and not be solitary, and you cannot be in solitude. You can have a very active social life and still be experience loneliness. You can live in a house full of people and still be lonely. But I think that, you know, there is a difference between solitude and loneliness, because you can also be in solitude for long periods of time and not feel lonely. So I think it is kind of like the germ of that is just absolutely true. And then there are of course all different offshoots, you know, to explore, but I think it's just a beautiful distillation.
Yeah, and you also write that our job as writers is both to see the world for what it is and to imagine a better one into being. I don't think there is any greater loneliness than looking directly at the untamable fury of our world, but it's also the only hope we have of finding our way to one another again. I love that.
Thank you. I mean, I think that writing a book about loneliness did genuinely make me less lonely. Like, I felt, I understood loneliness, and like, for me, the root of getting out of something is to understand it and to make sense of it. And I felt closer to humanity, I guess, or like being a human person by writing about loneliness. Like, it didn't feel, someone asked me in an interview the other day, like, if it made me more lonely, or if it made me feel depressed to write about these like big problems, and actually not. Like, confronting it really helped, I think.
Yeah, and this book stemmed from, you know, a certain sort of loneliness you were feeling right up, right around the 2016 election, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Definitely, yeah. And I don't know, I assume those things were probably related, you know, it was a very lonely time for a lot of people. Yeah, I just, you know, I started to draw people in publics, in isolated settings for this series that I worked on. And from there, I just started thinking about like what actually is loneliness and how does it work? So, yeah, it definitely came out of a period of loneliness for me. It was a kind of a transitionary time for me too. And I think it just kind of stuck with me and interested me in a pretty significant way.
And how would you go about, you know, cultivating a sense of solitude, which is, I think, important on some level, to be one with your thoughts, to be alone mm-hmm. with your thoughts,
yeah,
but not to devolve into loneliness. I mean, how would you navigate that?
I mean, it's very different for everyone. Like, everyone has different thresholds for how much time they can spend alone, for how much time they want to feel alone. You know, I have a friend who told me once she's never felt lonely in her entire life since she was like a young kid, which is amazing. And I have friends who are lonely every day, and friends who like still have like great relationships or kids or, you know, great communities of friends and family. Like, everyone is just so different in that way. So I think it's about, we do have to protect our time alone, particularly as artists, because it's, you know, unless you're a collaborative worker or someone with extraordinary focus, you have to spend a lot of time by yourself in order to work. So I think that is important, but it's kind of like that, you know, like the Don Draper sensibility we were talking about. It's like Don Draper can, anytime he wants to be around someone, he can access that person, like without question, because he's like handsome and rich and, you know, suave and whatever. But with writing, it's, you know, what you have, the goal is to have someone within reach or people that you value within reach when you're ready to reemerge. And I think that's the challenge, is that you can, you know, like there's a lot of, there's some studies that have kind of demonstrated that loneliness is contagious, that the longer you're lonely or isolated, the more likely you are to make other people feel like that, because you're not reaching out to them, so they're not going to reach out to you, kind of a thing. So I think sometimes spending a lot of time in solitude can be valuable but risky, because you need to, you know, our human relationships require work and maintenance, just like anything else.
One more thing I want to ask you, Kristen, is you know, I love to get a sense of get a recommendation from a guest for the listeners out there. You know, something that you would want to. It could be TV, it could be coffee, it could be a cool pair of socks. Mm-hmm. So, what would you recommend for the listeners out there?
I would recommend having something other than writing, or you will lose your mind. Like, I think that you have to have like an activity that matters to you and that can fuel you, that's not your work. And so for me, I would say that's probably, and beyond like your friends and family, you know, you kind of need something that's like a, you know, I guess a hobby is the word I'm looking for. I'm like, I recommend hobbies, but I think, you know, for me, that's plants. Like I grow plants, I tend to them, and that makes me feel like it is very calming and meditative, but it's also like a way to track progress in time that isn't about producing work or something like that. I mean, I guess it kind of is about producing work, because it is work and I am producing things and they're like proliferating throughout my garden, but it's not tied to like capitalism or, you know, art or something like that. Like, I feel different pressures, and it's something that's like just purely for pleasure.
I love it. Yeah. Yeah. Creating a green space inside is really important. It's invigorating. It really is.
Yeah, it totally.
Fantastic. Well, Kristen, for people who are not already familiar with your work, where can they find you online and get more familiar with you? And of course, you know, try to go and buy the book.
I guess they can find me on social media.
Yay.
That terrible place. that's where I am.
Thanks to Kristen. The book is Seek You, A Journey Through American Loneliness. I felt seen. I also felt deeply sad, but I'm a sad clown. Thanks for listening, CNFers. Thanks for the support. And thanks to West Virginia Wesleyan College's MFA in Creative Writing, as well as Hippocamp 2021 for the support. Thanks for being along on this joyride of a podcast. And just remember one thing. If you can do, interview. See ya.